For those of you who are remaining in here, those of you who are not children, if you have your Bibles, and you, if you will turn to Isaiah chapter 9. Do you ever look at some of the things that you just really enjoy and you wonder, why? Why do I enjoy these things? Where did that interest come from? Why is this a thing that I like so much? Most of you know this about me, that my default setting is optimism. One of my favorite things is encouraging people. Some of you have taken or seen the Clifton Strengths Finder. Well, according to the Strengths Finder, positivity is one of my core strengths. Jane likes to say that my glass is neither half empty nor half full, but is overflowing. Many of you have experienced this in relationship with me at some point, probably. Which is why it always strikes me as strange that I really like dark humor. And about once a year, I go to one of my favorite websites, despair.com. And I debate whether I should buy some of their demotivational posters, or at least one of their coffee mugs. True story, I owned one of their coffee mugs at one point. I don't know what happened to it, but I will find it. So this demotivator has actually always been my favorite. Failure, when your best just isn't good enough, right? There's a truth to it. It's rough. Something about that just makes me laugh a lot. You also know that I've changed offices in this building a number of times over the last 7 years, and even more if we go 15 years. And every time I change offices, I look at my blank walls and I think about changing my walls or covering them with demotivators. I don't know why, but for as hopeful and optimistic and positive and encouraging as I am naturally, there's something about these demotivational posters that just tickles me. I really like this newer one on motivation. If a pretty poster and a cute saying are all it takes to motivate you, you probably have a very easy job, the kind robots will be doing soon. It's dark. It's so true. I started thinking of these demotivational posters this week as I spent time with this morning's passage from Isaiah, actually. As I thought about Israel's history, and I reflected on the setting of our passage, I thought a lot about how unsettling Isaiah's words would be, about the tension that they would create. In Isaiah chapter 9, the prophet Isaiah comes and he announces a severe contrast. He says that in a former time, the land of Zebulun and Naphtali suffered. They lived in deep anguish, and their lives were covered with a cloud of gloom. But in a latter time, God is going to do something amazing, setting these people free from their darkness and oppression and constant war and despair, from no peace to peace. And it sounds almost as if Isaiah is standing in the middle of these two times, right? The former time and the latter time, looking back and then looking forward, but he's not. See, as Isaiah begins to speak, the former time, the time of anguish and gloom, contempt and darkness, has barely gotten started for them. And the latter time, the time of glory and of light, well, it's nowhere in sight. And this is where I started to think about these demotivational posters a bit. First, I thought of this one. Problems. No matter how great and destructive your problems may seem now, remember, you've probably only seen the tip of them. For those of you who don't know this about icebergs, 90% of the iceberg is underwater. heavy for people who have already faced significant challenges. Can you imagine someone coming to you because they're struggling with stuff, and as they're talking with you, you realize, oof, they aren't even close to being past this. Right? You think of like wanting to encourage them, it's all gonna be better, like things are turning around, things are, these problems, you recognize, barely scratch the surface of what's coming. For the Israelites that Isaiah was addressing, this couldn't have been more true. See, the people from Zebulun and Naphtali, they lived in the most northern regions of Israel, making them the border states between Israel and all of Israel's enemies to the north. For the most part, Israel is always getting attacked from the north throughout the scriptures, which meant these two groups of people, Zebulun and Naphtali, were always being attacked. More than once, in fact, an invading army would start to make their way through Israel, north to south, only to get defeated and kind of lose steam somewhere south of Zebulun and Naphtali. So even if the rest of Israel doesn't get conquered, Zebulun and Naphtali are constantly getting attacked and conquered. There's no peace for these people, no quiet. But more than that, they were part of a deep division that had long separated God's people into two different kingdoms, north and south. And on top of all of that, it had been a really long time since Zebulun and Naphtali had walked with their God personally. And if peace is completeness or wholeness, as we heard earlier in that video, then these people had no peace with God. They had no peace with their brothers and sisters, their fellow Israelites, and they had no peace with their enemies, their neighbors. And at the time of Isaiah, this lack of peace would have felt like a massive problem. Yet they can't see what's just over the horizon. The Assyrians, the greatest and most brutal empire the world had yet seen up till that point, was preparing at that moment to come and completely lay waste to the region. And the people of Zebulun and Naphtali were about to be stripped from their homes, taken away as captives and sent all over the world. They're about to lose everything. Their current problems, the problems they're currently experiencing when Isaiah speaks to them, are just the tip of the iceberg. And I don't know, maybe this is part of why I'm drawn to these demotivational posters. Like, as much as I'm positive and an optimist, I truly care deeply about the truth. I want the truth to reign in my life. I don't want to live my life by some rose-colored fantasy about what could be. Which means that, like, if I've just done something dumb, which is a lot of the time, but I'm facing consequences for it, and you see me struggling with this, like, I don't want you to tell me that everything's about to get better if you can see where this leads and see that there are actually more consequences coming. It doesn't do me any good for you to tell me it's all about to turn around. Right? Because I can't actually have true peace if I'm living based on a lie. No matter how optimistic or confident I am, it's a false peace that will disappear the moment things get hard. True peace is the ability to walk into the truth with eyes wide open. And so while these demotivational posters feel harsh, they also name truths that can be hard to name. And they can give us sometimes a chance to laugh at ourselves and maybe even our circumstances. And it just so happens that that our passage made me think of another poster this week. And so here's the next one. Despair. It's always darkest just before it goes pitch black. You can tell all of these are like some twist on like a motivation. Like, it's always darkest just before like the morning. No, it's always darkest just before it goes pitch black. In verse 2, Isaiah is talking about people who walked in darkness. He is referring to people who dwelt in a land of deep darkness. He's announcing that these people have seen a great light and that on them a light shone. But these people haven't even begun to see real darkness yet. The darkness to come is going to make everything else feel like dusk. And so in many ways, this is about perspective. But more than that, the people, because they don't understand the darkness that they are in, there's a problem with the way that they are engaging the darkness. There's a problem with what they're trying to do about the darkness because they think that the darkness is just about to pass. And now, we didn't read this morning, but in the chapter right before ours, chapter 8, we find out that the people have developed a number of strategies of dealing with the darkness. And you might find these familiar because these seem to be normal, natural ways for humans to engage with dark circumstances, heavy circumstances, suffering, challenges. So the first person that we discover is the king. The king tries to deal with the constant fighting and warfare. Right? There's no peace because we're fighting with our neighbors and our enemies and even our brothers and sisters all the time. And so the king thinks the solution is we will make alliances with the right neighbors. If we just make the right alliances, then we will have peace. But Isaiah and other prophets are running around saying, telling the kings to stop doing this. This is a bad strategy. See, true peace cannot be found through the right alliance. True peace can only be found listening to God and trusting Him. Ultimately, Isaiah will tell the story of the king making an alliance, the alliance that will ultimately bring the darkness on the people. He thinks he's making an alliance to bring peace, but it's actually this alliance that is going to crush his own people. Then there are the leaders. This is below the king. These are the religious leaders, the political leaders. Isaiah and the other prophets, they're busy running around announcing that dark days are coming. But if you can imagine, you're the leaders of God's people, like that's not very like inspiring or like hope giving to your people. How do you keep your people together if they're all just lamenting and despairing what's coming? And so the leaders of God's people have created a propaganda campaign against the prophets. So here's what happens. A prophet comes out and begins to speak the truth about what's coming, announcing this deeper darkness that's coming. And the leaders, they rile up the people together by calling the message a conspiracy against the king. They point to the prophets and they say, they're just trying to create problems for the king. They are just being divisive. And so they treat the prophets like troublemakers. So see, the leaders think that they can create peace by shutting up the prophets. But what they are really doing is they are shutting down the only channel that can lead people to true peace. So you have the kings and you have the leaders all working for their version of peace. But the people are also guilty. See, the prophets keep calling them to seek God, but instead they're going everywhere else. They're going to fortune tellers. They're going to mediums. See, they're looking for anybody who might be considered an expert on the future to help them understand the darkness that they're currently in, to help them understand how to escape it. And the whole time they're looking for escape, but they're resisting the word of God. And the word of God just keeps speaking to them, come back to me. God calls his people back to him while they are in the darkness. But from the king all the way down to the commoners, everyone is looking for ways of getting rid of the darkness on their own. And their efforts end up bringing them into a more complete and total darkness. I mean, this is what's happening is the people are searching for peace. They're striving for peace. And in the process, they're creating less and less peace for themselves. Their efforts to reject God's promises, to reject God's words, to reject God's presence keeps plunging them into utter darkness, which made me think of another poster. I got another one of these. Perseverance, the courage to ignore the obvious wisdom of turning back. One of the defining characteristics of Israel in our scriptures is that during this part of their history is their perseverance as they run headlong into destruction. The whole while, the voice of God is calling them back to himself. We think of perseverance as a virtue. That's part of what makes motivational posters work is you put a virtue up and you say something about that, but perseverance isn't always a virtue. Not when we persevere, when we press on in foolishness. God is calling his people to seek him in the midst of the darkness. And I think it's safe to say that this is actually one of the overarching themes of the entire Bible, that our world can be a difficult place. We know this, right? Life can be hard. There are so many things that are outside of our control. Sometimes life can just feel heavy, but sometimes life is oppressive. And often it feels like there's no escape. But all of this is bearable with God. In fact, the scriptures suggest that you can even thrive in the midst of devastating circumstances if you will seek God in the midst of them. History is full of these testimonies. Women and men who, under incredible pain and suffering, drew close to their God and experienced inexplicable joy. The depths of love, the greatest of hopes in the midst of what couldn't be described as anything other than terrible situations. I recently heard about this new TV show called The Misery Index. Has anybody seen it? No? Okay. Cool. So here's the game. They've turned it into a game. They've somehow made a game out of taking all of the worst human experiences and ranking them on a misery scale, 1 to 100. So there's a guy with a 2-inch leech that gets pulled out of his nose. And there's someone else who somehow accidentally kills a dove in his hands while giving a eulogy before he can release it. Or there's a person who goes into surgery to get a leg amputated, and you can see where this is going. Wrong one gets chopped off and still has to get the original one lopped off after. So lots of stuff, lots of things happen to people. The show uses psychological research and active psychologists in then rating and determining how real people experience each of these events on a scale, on a misery scale. So the show sounds interesting. But it also seems to be missing something. Bad stuff is a given. But I want to know, how does God's presence in our life change the way we experience bad stuff? If we experience something as a 99 or 100 on the misery index, can we still thrive? Can we still live and experience peace? When we see Jesus on the cross, hanging there, nails in his hands, nails in his feet, a crown of thorns dug into his skull, his flesh shred to bits after 39 lashes, he experiences the deepest darkness and the most excruciating pain. And he feels far from God. And yet, in the midst of that, he offers life to the thief on the cross next to him. And he prays for forgiveness for those who have wronged him. And he takes care of his mother and his best friend. And in a deep and inexplicable peace, he entrusts his life to his Father. The cross has to be 100 on the misery index, right? And yet you look at everything that Jesus is doing on the cross and you have to wonder if it's even registering. Obviously, the suffering is immense, but so is the peace that our Father gives. This is the life that God is inviting us into, a life that is marked by his presence and his peace, regardless of circumstances. When life isn't going well for you, I mean, are your circumstances all that you can focus on? Is your only goal to change your circumstances or to be a little more positive in the face of them, make them a little bit more manageable? Or is there something deeper at work in you? Like, are your responses marked by God's peace or your impatience? Does your life appear to others as a movement of God's peace? Or when people look at your life, do they see just this constant reaction to the stuff around you? It's worth looking at what Jesus accomplishes while he's on the cross, right? I mean, he offers life to a criminal. He forgives his enemies, the ones who put him on the cross. He restores relationships and he dies at peace. In each of these things, Jesus acts as a vessel of God's peace. He offers wholeness to the criminal and to his enemies. He offers wholeness. And to his friends and family, he offers this wholeness, this completeness, this relationship. And he's able to do this because in his darkness, he turns to his Father. And it's there on the cross, the darkest of moments in all of human history, that the light of God just radiates. Right? Not because Jesus tried to escape his darkness or minimize his darkness, but because God's very presence brings light in the darkness. This is ultimately what the season of Advent is about. You may be familiar with this. You may be aware of this. Human beings don't do so well in the darkness. It starts when we're young. Who likes the darkness? In the darkness, our instinct is to scramble for light, to pretend it's not dark. And even for those who believe that God is there, For those who trust that he's there, the darkness is the time where that trust is put to the test. Psychologist and Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, he has demonstrated that this is an instinctive human response to any situation. His research shows that humans will constantly jump to conclusions based on limited information, meaning if you can't see something, our minds don't register that it's there. And so it's as simple as in our ordinary lives, presenting only one side of evidence or debate in a case. Having heard one side, if we can't see another side or if we're unfamiliar with the other side, we automatically assume that what we've been presented is all there is. He calls this phenomenon, what you see is all there is. That we live as though what we see is all there is. That's our default orientation. And that means that in the midst of whatever life circumstances I'm experiencing, if I can't see God, if I don't feel God, if it's not obvious that God is doing something, then our instinctive conclusion is that God must not be here. But Advent announces God's coming. Advent reminds us year after year. It immerses us in the truth that God promised to come and that he has come. So that regardless of what we can see, we know that there's more. Our passage this morning lays the groundwork for really an earth-shaking announcement. When you are in the darkness, you don't have to simply wait for it to get darker, and you can't strive for it to get lighter. Wherever you're at, God is doing something. Isaiah announces that a child would be born, and that child would be God himself, and this child will bring comfort and strength and care and peace to the world. And these aren't things that we just wishfully hope are true and available to us. Like, we don't have to live in darkness wondering where God is. See, the Advent announcement is that God is coming into the darkness with us. Like, Advent literally means coming. And so this season reminds us that God came after promising that he would, and that God suffered the deepest darkness, darker and deeper than anything than you and I have ever known, as Jesus suffered on the cross. And God did this so that we would never have to wonder if it's possible to survive in the darkness. Not only can we survive, but we can truly thrive in the darkness. We can bring peace to criminals. We can bring and offer peace to our enemies, peace to friends and family, and peace for ourselves as we face our own deaths. We can bring restoration, and we can bring wholeness to our world. Not one day when the darkness is all gone, but in this moment, while the world is still in darkness, because Jesus did it for us. And then he gave us his spirit so that he could continue to do it for others through us. God's very spirit in us shines brightly in the darkness. Have you seen it? Have you seen the light of God shine brightly in the darkness? I have. The darkness isn't eliminated. I think this is one of the things that's the hardest for us to live with each day. Terrible stuff still happens. Our lives are still filled with pain and grief. And yet, there is peace. And where there is peace, God's light is shining. And it continues to call to those who are in the darkness. The very last line of verse 7. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. The zeal of the Lord. Do you know how passionate God is in his pursuit of you? When we couldn't see him in the darkness, when we lost faith that he was there, he took on flesh and dwelt among us. Because if human beings have this impossible time getting out of the mindset that what you see is all there is, then God wasn't going to just let us or tell us to believe harder. God is going to make sure that we could see him and touch him and hear him. And so a child was born to us, a son was given. Will you see him today? Hear him? Touch him? As we come to the table in a few minutes, we're even invited to taste so that in the darkness you might know Emmanuel, that God is with us.